Hello everybody and welcome back to the Isle of Wight show with me, Joe Redston. Today I am talking to Simon Ledger, well-known local musician and promoter. Among other things, Simon and I discuss the time he worked for the Russian Mafia, the charity single that he did for the Mountbatten Hospice a few years back, and that was connected to losing both his dad and his stepdad at a fairly young age. We talk about his work as a promoter, which included a time that he did some stuff for the Olympics, which didn't quite go according to plan. And we finish up with a discussion about the state of the music industry and what TV shows like The X Factor, the impact that they may have had. It's a fascinating conversation. We jump about a little bit, and I hope you guys enjoy it as much as I did. Here is Simon Ledger. Okay, so I'm here today with Simon Ledger, who I'm sure is a name that is familiar to a lot of people out there. First of all, thank you ever so much for joining me today, Simon. Really appreciate that.
No problem.
And to begin with, mate, can you just give me a little bit of your Isle of Wight story? You know, were you born here or did you move here? Have you spent much time away? Just a kind of basic introduction to who you are.
I'm born and bred Isle of Wighter. In 77 at St Mary's, a different looking St Mary's to what it is now, no sort of rainbow triangle at the front. I was born there, and my mum was originally from Yorkshire and moved down to the island to work at a hotel that it turned out my granddad owned in the Halland in Seaview, which isn't there anymore, and I don't know if you'd remember it, but it was there's all apartments there now, but in the 70s it was one of the major hotels on the island. And my granddad had that hotel, and he needed summer waitresses and things like that. And my mum came down with a friend, and my mum met my dad because he ran a disco, a nightclub there called The Beehive, which is in there. And you had all the old clubs like The Carousel and things like that. And he did promotional and DJ nights there. And they met and got together. And they used to double date with my stepfather and his girlfriend at the time, which is quite ironic. They double dated. So that's how they came. My dad came from Tunbridge Wells originally, I believe. And my granddad was the one that came down to the island first because he was an MP, a Labour MP, quite a famous one, in Romford. Oh. He was the first ever Dr. Bernardo's boy to become an MP.
Wow, I had no idea about that.
Yeah, and my granddad was quite well known. He was a very good politician, and he was a Labour MP, Romford it was, yeah. And then he came down, got that, and he took over a casino as well, which is Hollier's. If you remember Hollier's, yeah, that used to be a casino, and he had that as a casino, and it was a strange setup. I know that I'm sure he had one of the first Jags. In the UK, yellow one, and he bought my nan a mini or something. And this famous story is, I don't remember it, is that when I was about 3 years old, I climbed in and let the handbrake off and it crashed into the other one. And apparently he was crying in the tool shed to stop him. I've been told that I did that, but right, I can't remember.
Excellent. No, well, that's good. Yeah, clear that one from your memory banks. Cool. Okay, so yeah, so as you say, born and bred. I think probably the thing that most people would know you for is obviously as a musician. You know, you do a lot of gigs on and around the island. Just give us a little bit of background where that came from. Did you play early?
So my mum and dad separated when I was about one, and my dad went off to be a DJ in Norway. But he would send me, he was quite a famous DJ out there, and he would send me vinyl over, and he would send me white label records because he had a connection. So I was at a very early age, they picked up that I had an ear for music at school. And my dad would send over these records from bands like D-Train and Prince, and no one had heard of them at the time. They were like very, very unheard of. And he would send through what he thought would be hits. And a lot of DJs would go and buy records from him because he would predict what ones were going to sell well and which ones wouldn't. And he had a contact at EMI, I think it was. And so I inherited that, my music side, from my dad. Yeah. But my mum and my stepfather, Wayne, they got me piano lessons at school. I had drum lessons, I had singing lessons, and I had that at school. And then I almost gave up because it was all classical, and I appreciate classical now, but at the time it was like all my friends are playing football and rugby and all that, and there I'm in the choir, which I loved, but I'm playing classical pieces and scales every day, and I almost gave it up. My mum found a teacher, I can't remember if you remember him, Mike in Ride. He had a hunch on his back, bless him. He was a really lovely guy. He was quite well known, and he did more jazz and pop music, and she got me some sheet music of like Michael Jackson Bad, and I think there was a Rick Astley one at the time, and I got to play songs that I heard on the radio. And so I didn't give up. And that's where, and then literally I was 11 or 12 and my mum got me to do a summer job waiting on at a hotel, Luckham Hall Hotel. And we knew the owner and I was doing a shift in the morning, I think just waiting on and for some pocket money. And I started playing the piano afterwards. And in the end, he offered me £50 to play the piano that night to do it. And I didn't know what I was bricking it. I was just turned 12.
Right, 50 quid when
you're
12.
Yeah, 50 quid. Nice. I know, that's what I was thinking. And I was playing. It was down to Mike Drury, really good. He was fireman on the island, quite a well-known fireman. And it was down to him. And I started doing like gigs like that. And it was like really weird. And then I started adding singing to it. And then I had a little drum machine to do it. You know, there were no tracks those days. And then, I did an audition at Hollyer's. And I'll never forget it because I was 12 or 13. And we knew Joan and Paul Otley, known them for years. And I remember playing with a drum machine. I'm sure I was doing Country Roads. And I was playing, and it was just playing the piano. And I had a pint of water, and it must have vibrated, and it broke, and it smashed on the keys. But no one could really hear because I was playing and singing. And I was so nervous, I didn't want them to like notice, that I carried on playing. And I had splinters of glass in my fingers. There was blood all over the white keys. It was a white piano as well, Baby Grand. And I carried on. Yeah, so that's how I got it. That's how I got into it, and that's how I obviously ended up gigging full time.
Okay, I mean, you still gig at Hollyer's now, don't you?
Yeah, I do every Tuesday. Yeah, I do. I don't do as much. Obviously, the whole pub game and club game, it's all nightclubs. It's all changed now, but it is nice. I go in there on a Tuesday, and then in the winter you'll have coach parties, so it's more of your older stuff and a bit of comedy with them. But in the summer, and you got tourists walking past, couples and that, you can play pretty much anything, and it's quite nice. And the same piano shell is still in Hollyer's now that was there then. Ron Bird actually, I'm sure, supplied that years ago. But it died about the, you just couldn't tune it anymore about 5-6 years ago, so it's got a keyboard in it now. And it's nice to go in and play it and still look at it. It's,
but they've cleaned up the blood, I hope.
Yeah. There's a few Sambuca stains, that's it.
Excellent. And was there, I mean, you said you played a bit of drums and stuff like that as well. Was there something like, you know, one of the things that when I speak to musicians, one of the sort of common stories that I hear is if you continue to play beyond your school days, it tends to be on an instrument that you've got a real connection with. Is that true for you with the piano? Do you still love playing the piano?
Yeah, I do. I play a guitar more at the moment, and a lot of it causes a bit of controversy sometimes because it's quite a psychological thing. Well, people will look at it and think it doesn't sound as good as a piano, yet it's the same sounds as a Roland stage piano. It's got the same sounds in it, exactly the same, but it looks different. So I've done that for the last 6 years because I want to be a little bit different. I will still go and play piano, so I do at Hollyer's, but most of the other gigs, when I was playing hotels and pubs, I was playing £3,000 or £4,000 keyboards. No one would come up and ask you about the keyboard unless they were a keyboard player or musician. But with a guitar, everyone asks. I've never done, and I'm not exaggerating, I've never done a gig where not one person has come up and said, excuse me, what's your left hand doing, or what's that instrument called, or what? And I like it because it's different. So guitarists hate it, and I get that, but I try not to do too many guitar solos. But yeah, it's the piano is the thing. Drums was a weird thing for me because you'll know the guy, it was Jack.
Jack Richards.
Yeah, Jack Richards was a teacher at Ride, and he came in, and they had never had drum lessons before. And I came in, and my dad used to be a drummer, and I hadn't really played the drums. So they got me to play drums, and I was doing it was a Grease show or something at school, and the main guy lost his voice, so I was playing drums on it, so I had to sing it and play drums on the first time, and I was okay. I was an okay drummer. I wasn't, you know, the best, but I could get away with it. And then I think I did the theatre thing with you. Was it you? When we did at Medina, we did the Isle of Wight Concert Band on a Saturday, and we had to do like a drum piece with Ian.
I didn't do too much with the concert band.
It was the orchestra or something like that, and it was Ian. There was about five of us, and we had to do this piece, and it was amazing. And I played percussion on it, so I had to do marimba, and it was all new, but I didn't carry it on. So if you asked me to play drums now, I wouldn't. I'd be no good. I'm a piano player.
Okay, so I mean that's a lot of gigs that you've done, multiple thousands of gigs that you've done over the years. I mean, are there any particular gigs that have really stuck in your head over the years for whatever reason?
There's a few. There was one when I was 13, and a guy came up, and the usual story, and you've probably heard this before, is when they come up and say that they are connected with a record label or they're this person or that, and normally I'm one of these people that if they're a genuine person like that, they don't normally name drop or they don't normally say it. You find out at a later date or something like that. And this guy came up and told me he was Stevie Wonder's manager. And I was like, yeah, whatever, gave me a card. And anyway, as it turned out, apparently he was. But I missed out and I threw the card away. So that was my own fault. That was one. And I was young then and naive. Another one, one of the craziest ones I've had, and people don't tend to believe me at first when I say this, was I got a random phone call from a guy called Dave Wright, and Dave and Marquini were on the island at the time. They're from New Zealand, and I know you know them. And they were doing teaching and things like that. And I'd come back from a cruise ship, and I had a month off, and literally I got a phone call saying, can you get to Nice tomorrow? And I was in Newport at a car paint place or something, and on the phone I was like, well maybe what, and they said, there's a gig, you need to get over to Portsmouth this afternoon and meet this captain in a pub. And there was this pub right by the old bus, where the bus station is, there's a naval pub there. I had to meet him in there, and it was to play on this yacht, and I had to meet this captain. So he sort of interviewed me and said, right, can you do this, can you do that? And he said, right, how much? And I was like, I don't know, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what I said. It was like 10 days or 12 days. And they paid for the cost to get out there. So I was like, right, what have you got to do? And he said, well, you've got to be on call 24/7. You can't leave your cabin if this family are on the yacht. But he wouldn't say who they were. And but if they call you out, then you've got to come out and play. So I didn't really know. So I just went, $2,000 or something like that. And they went, right, fine, deal, done. So I was like, all right, okay. And then I got some more details. I turned up at I think it was Heathrow the next day, my car, I was 17 or 18, and I had all my equipment, I had to bring everything, speakers, everything. And in those days, they were really heavy. And the BA wanted nearly $2,000 in excess baggage, and I didn't have it. So I had to phone this agent in France. They paid for it on credit card. I was first class, and then when I got to Nice, it picked me up in a stretch limo, and we were loading all this old speakers into this stretch limo. I went down to Monaco, and then I had to get onto this mega yacht, and then this young lad came up. He was about, I think he was about 18 or 19, something like that, in a brand new Aston Martin, and he had a Porsche, and it was all weird, and I was shown where to go, and they had a beautiful Steinway on there, this piano, lovely, and the carpets, and I turned out I was working for a Russian family, and I didn't really know much about it. And I ended up doing about 6 hours work in the whole 12 days. And I had to play some songs. It was a bit strange, but I got really bored because I couldn't leave the camera. I wasn't allowed to talk to them unless they talked to me. And it turned out they said to me, they said, we recognize your name, your surname, Ledger. Do you know Bernard Ledger? And I said, well, yes, that's my uncle. And my uncle's been a doorman, not as in like a nightclub doorman, but on the front door of the Hilton in Geneva for like 30, 35 years, and parked all the cars for Roger Moore and all, knew them all. And I phoned him and said, look, I've got this family. And he said the name. I won't say who they were. But it turns out I was working for a Russian mafia family. Right. So I'm in Monaco going around Corsica, Sardinia and everything. We're going, this is nuts. And they were paying like $200,000 a day or something. It was ridiculous. $200,000 a day for this. But it was mental. And a jacuzzi opened up, a swimming pool opened up, closed up as a helicopter launch pad. And the dad was flying in and out. He was in the oil business. And it was, and I was like, didn't know what the hell to think. And then they took me out to a nightclub and I met Jean-Claude Van Damme. Madonna had been there, they knew everything, and it was just completely nuts. And then my uncle said to me, this family are like really nice family, but they take up like the penthouse, or they take up the top floor of the Hilton for 6 months at a time in Hiltons around the world. They are mega. And I basically ended up working for the Russian mafia without even knowing it. But I wouldn't do it again. I was bored.
Cool. Nice one. That's good. So one of the other things that I feel like I get asked a little bit as well, when you've been playing for a little while and done a number of gigs that you've done and stuff as well, do you ever still get nervous about anything?
No, I don't. I'm not really a nervous person. I've done stadium gigs, I've done gigs with like celebrities and thousands of people. And it's not, for me, it's not nerves. I get sometimes apprehension if it's something I don't know about. If I know what the gig entails, then I'm fine in advance. I'm fine with it. But sometimes I'm like, is this going to work? And I, it's not nerves. It's weird. I don't really get that. I just want to get out there and get done. And then afterwards you sort of go, wow. And then the adrenaline kicks in, obviously. And I get that side of it, but I've never really been frightened of doing it or felt sick or anything like that. It's weird. Yeah. So a lot of people, some do, some don't.
Yeah. And I guess that probably partly explains why one of the things that I sort of admire about you and what you do is you're kind of always busy. You're always doing this, and then you've always got another project going on, and then you're traveling and you're going away and doing all these kind of things. One of the things that has really sort of stuck in my head, and correct me if I get the dates wrong, I think it was 2011 when you did the charity single.
Yeah, it was 2011.
Okay,
yeah.
So for people who might be a little bit unsure what the hell I'm talking about, just give us a little bit of background on what that charity single was about.
Right, so for years I'd loved the song, the We Are The World song, and at Christmas everyone would do versions of Do They Know It's Christmas and things like that, and I always said I'd love to do a version of We Are The World, but use like all Isle of Wight singers, so that you got like different voices and do that. And I thought about it for 5 or 6 years and said it to several people. And then my dad died on 2008 he died. So what I wanted to do was do a single for the hospice, to raise some money for the hospice. I knew the events or the fundraising lady there, Karen, and I wanted to donate some money to hospice because he'd been in there. And I thought, rather than just like, I had £1,000 I wanted to donate, and I thought rather than just give £1,000, I'd rather try and invest it in something that might make some more money. Yeah. And together we worked out, and I said about this single, and we put it together, and I put the feelers out there and just asked a lot of different Isle of Wight acts, different voices, and then I spoke to Dave Waite and Stu Fisher at Skinny Mama Studios, and they were up for coming on board and doing it, and what they did was amazing. And we started by just playing in the track, and Stu did the drums, and we did it, and then had to have a think about who I would put on the parts. It wasn't just a case of you do that. I was trying to not match the voices to the original, but so that they were suitable, and some voices blended well and some wouldn't. You know, if you had a rock singer, you don't want to put them with a soft folk singer. You know, it was trying to do it one after the other differently. And if you go on YouTube and look up We Are The World, The Making, which is the original one, it's so interesting to see, because Michael Jackson was credited with most of it, but Lionel Richie was actually the main force behind it, which is quite interesting. And hearing the voices, there was some Cyndi Lauper had to do about 7 or 8 takes because they did it through the night, and her jewellery kept going off. She had so much jewellery on, and it's hilarious. You've got to watch it, the making. It's brilliant. And some of them are horrendous on there. I mean, they had to really like mess with their voices. So I thought, oh, we'll have a go at it. And it was supposed to just be a little thing, just sell some CDs, something like that. And then I remember one of the local radio stations guys came in and heard it and couldn't believe it. And that was down to Stu and Dave as well, because they made it such a great production. And, you know, I just said to all of them, OK, look, let's all get together and just sing the chorus together. OK, right, everybody, if you feel you can harmonise, just whack a harmony in. And we did it like 12 times. And the next thing you know, it sounds like we had a gospel choir there. It was amazing. And we videoed it as well. But people didn't see the work that went into that. I mean, I was with Maurice Gilliam. We spent like 40 plus hours editing the video, because there were 4 cameras like going around getting the right singers at the right time. And it just sort of came together. It came together much bigger and better than I thought it would. And the next thing you know, they sort of, South Today wanted it, you know, BBC wanted to hear it. And it ended up raising 7,000 plus. So rather than just give £1,000, we invested it, and it brought attention to the hospice as well.
Yeah, which, I mean, that just as a principal, that sounds really just sort of smart to me. You know, like you said, you know, it would have been a, you know, fantastic gesture for you to have just donated that £1,000 in the first place, but to be able to, you know, kind of turn that into into seven is an amazing thing.
Yeah, the thing is that I didn't, you know, I wouldn't want the hospice to have committed money where they would lose money, so I would have always covered that regardless anyway, because despite it being a charity, there are costs. A hospice is a business at the end of the day. It's quite sad to say, like a hospital, you know, and they do have costs. So the way we did it was, it just came together, and then I just thought of the name Isle of Wight Unite. Mm-hmm. And we put it out there. The only mistake I made was putting 2011, the year, on the CD, because when you go, if you play it to people now, you can sell it to them, they think it's up because they think it's too old, because they don't, even though it's for charity and it's going, all the money's going to it, because it's got the year date on it. And that was a lesson I learned.
Oh, well, so when you do your next one, you'll know not to put
no date on it.
Excellent. And then, so you said your dad passed away 2008. And then, so I hope, you know, this might be a little bit personal, but, you know, you must have been, you know, well, younger than you are now, but relatively young guy at that point. You know, what kind of, how do you think that's kind of affected you over the last 10 years?
Well, it's strange, because, like, my stepdad passed away very suddenly in 2003. And literally, was my mum, my brother and my sister, and they were very young. They were 13 and 15, I think it was. So suddenly I was like, not the man of the house as such, because I wasn't living there, but I had to sort of step in, and mum and Wayne had clothes shops on the island, Pearly Boys and things like that. And literally he was going to be retiring the next year. And it was a shock, because he was very healthy, very young looking. And it was just a complete shock, and it shouldn't have happened. Unfortunately it did. It was... down to certain factors that we couldn't, you know, I've had several arguments with St Mary's at the time, because St Mary's had had problems. They had run out of medication quite often. And it's not, I'm not here to slag St Mary's off. We had to make points. We had to do an inquiry and force them to do an inquiry so that it didn't happen to somebody else. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was dealing with that. I didn't have time to be upset, because, you know, I wanted to make sure my mum was okay. And they were all amazing for it as well. And we got on. And so when my dad became terminally ill, it was a different thing. It was a process of a year. And I just literally signed to do a contract on the ship, and I didn't really want to do it, but dad said, no way, you're not staying here. And I was frightened. And then, you know, as it happened, I got back, and, you know, I was here when he died. So I'd already gone through it once. Yeah. So I sort of knew what to expect. And for me, it was a different thing, because it was a year of seeing someone suffer, and that's not nice. And for me, it was a relief to see so that he isn't in pain. Whereas with my stepfather, it was very sudden shock, happened instantly, and we're like, wow, what the hell's going on? You know, you don't know. So it was two different things. And the real spooky thing was they both died on the same date, July 28th. So like 5 years apart, which is like pretty nuts really, but you learn to deal with it. And the thing is that they were both not really nice characters. Anyone that knew them will say the same, that they were so nice, these two guys, that they wouldn't be bothered. They would want everyone to carry on as normal, get on with it. They would be annoyed if you didn't nothing, and you sat there moping. So it's one of those things. And it was the music. And funnily enough, with my dad, he'd never seen me gig. He'd seen me gig, but he'd never seen me gig with Joey, my best friend. Yeah. And we love Earth, Wind and Fire, bands like that. And my dad was the influence there, because they were his favourite bands. Steely Dan, all that. He loved all that. So we took him down to Hollier's to see us gig. And he wasn't very well at the time. He was going through chemo and he was really struggling. He had a few beers and he loved it. And I remember we were packing the equipment down, and I looked around and I said to Joe, where's my dad gone? We couldn't find him. We were like, what? And Joey's wife and her friends, it turned out, had taken him down to Colonel Bogey's, to the nightclub. We didn't even know. So I go down there, and he's in there dancing to Chaka Khan, Ain't Nobody, one of his favourite songs. He's there on the dance floor, dancing with all the girls around him. And it was like, for me, that was brilliant, because that was amazing, because that was the time of swimming joy. And then on my 30th, we got him to DJ a bit. I had a party in Bogey's, and I got him to get up, and he did a little set of 20 minutes of like D-Train and Jocelyn Brown, Somebody Else Sky, all the stuff that he put onto me. He played all that, and it was really cool to see. He hadn't DJed for years, so it was cool. You deal with, everyone has tragedy at some point in their life, and it's just you get, for me it's happened twice, so you get used to it, and obviously it's tough, but I had other things in a way to worry about, like my brother and sister and my mum, you know, and for it, that for me was what took care of it. I didn't sit there being upset. I thought, right, I've got to do something to try and help him here, you know, and that's the way that's how it happens normally.
No, thanks for sharing that, man. Appreciate that. So I touched on this just now. You know, one of the things that, you know, always really, really strikes me about you is your, you know, the amount of stuff that you do. You know, you're always busy. You're not a guy, or you don't appear to be a guy who can, you know, sort of just sit down and chill out and take it easy. That kind of, that work ethic that you've got, you know, kind of constantly looking around for the new thing, the new opportunity. Is that something, is that like a conscious decision on your part, or is that just part of your DNA?
It just happened. My mum's always been a get up and go person like that, you know, but for me, I was gigging, and I'll be honest with you, I got to a point where I was doing ships. I've been on and off ships for about 20 years, 23 years, I think it was. And I was doing the summer here and the winter on the ship, and it worked perfectly. But I was getting to the stage where I was doing some gigs where I was waking up in the morning thinking, why am I doing this? I'm playing the same songs, you know, and it was nothing about the songs. There was nothing wrong with the songs. But if you're singing Daydream Believer or Country Roads 7 nights a week for years, you get to the point where you think, why am I still doing it? You know, and I needed a break to do it. And then I kept getting phone calls saying, oh, do you know anyone that could do this gig? Or do you know anyone? And I ended up sort of going in to being not an agent as such, but booking gigs as a booker. And then I was doing some events, and then I managed to secure the Cowes Week event, which has been a major part of my life. And it's like, we're really, really good, and it's stressful, and there's a lot going on, but we love it. You know?
Yeah. So that's, you organise essentially the entertainment on the parade.
I used to do the Yacht Haven originally. I used to put DJs and some bands on that. And then I've come across to the parade village, which I love. It's free. It's family atmosphere. It's a different type of atmosphere. It's much more chilled out in the day. And the difference is that a lot of promoters and that will go in and they will get a budget and they'll say, right, you've got to put on so many bands a day for 10 days, and then you've got to make your money out of it. So they will go and think, what's the cheapest bands I can get to make the most money? Whereas I don't go on that. I'm quite unique. That was my USP when I went into these events, because I say, you pay me a fee, I'll book everything for you. And that way I will always book you the best, because for me, it's not all about the money. It is about getting the right acts on there. And sometimes I don't get it right, you know, you've got to try it. We had this is a couple of years ago, we got a Rat Pack show, and I always wanted to put a Rat Pack show on. And my boss and I talked about it, and we went for it, and we got these guys. They were brilliant. Mm-hmm. They were absolutely amazing, but it just went over the heads because the crowd just wanted to get drunk and have a dance and party. Okay. So the dialogue in between didn't work, you know, so we don't.
So it was a show.
It was more of a show with dialogue in it. And, you know, and I knew that. I've seen the show 8-9 times, you know, and it's, I just thought it might work, and it needed to be earlier in the afternoon, really. And lesson learned, and then, you know, sometimes you get it right, sometimes you don't, but the key is that I always feel that you try, if I was doing it in a normal promoter way, then I would be thinking, well, I've got to make money here. In fact, if I was doing it that way, I would never make any money, because I'd be booking all the best bands still and I'd make no money. So that was my USP and different events, and so I've fallen into events now, so I've cut back slightly on the gigging. Right. So I don't pick and choose what I do, but I am more careful and wary about how many nights I was doing, things like that. And I've tried different things. I've went abroad to Fuerteventura for 6 months, mm-hmm. And had a great fun out there and did some shows out there. I've come back. I've done some other crazy events, the Olympic thing was a big thing, which turned out to be not so great. But yeah,
that was you organised the entertainment down in Weymouth, didn't you?
Yeah, well, it was a strange one because I never expected to get it. But basically, somebody I knew had got the tender for the entertainment onshore for the sailing part of the Olympics, and I put a bid in and put a proposal together, a presentation. I was going against these massive companies. I never thought I'd get it. And I got the gig, and I spent a year on it, and we booked hundreds and hundreds of acts, like different types. We had stages, street performers, everything. And it was chaos. And I was a bit silly because I did it all myself pretty much. And it needed to be a team of three or four, really. It was so mad. And my phone was going off day and night, and then it was interfering with my gigs and things like that. But I don't regret it. Unfortunately, it was one of quite a few festivals that went bust. We lasted about 7 days. Four festivals went bust in London. And my big feeling on it is, and I went to several meetings in London, is that everyone remembers the 2012 Olympics for the gold medals, Mo Farah, Jessica Ennis, all those. They remember that. But no one's talked about how much money the UK owes still for that and will do for years to come. LOCOG, which was Sebastian Coe, Boris Johnson, all that group, that's disbanded now because obviously there's not going to be another Olympics in our lifetime. And there was millions and millions wasted everywhere. Right. And I always said I'd like to know how many businesses went bust during or after that Olympic period, because there was a lot. Car hire places weren't getting hired because BMW supplied all the vehicles for the whole of the Olympic teams and all that, and so there was nothing. It was all hyped up, and I lost a lot of money on it. Mm-hmm. I lost my time. I lost a lot of money, right. But I don't regret it. Lesson learned, and I had to sort of not sit there and mope and crack on, and get on with it. And you learn, don't you? That's the way.
That's a really big part of it, right? We all get things wrong occasionally, and it's the ability to rebound from that and learn from those mistakes. Cool. And as you say, crack on.
The weird thing was that I was actually, I'd made a little bit of money in a house. I was doing some work to a house to sell it, and that was going to be my little nest egg to buy somewhere nice from my old house. And I was looking at a Subway franchise on the island, and there was one in Rye, but it wasn't one in Newport. And I was just about to commit to it, and then this came up, and I needed the money for expenses for the year. Yeah. So I gambled my money on that
on the Olympics.
I could have been serving you Subway.
Yeah, a little bit different.
Yeah.
A little bit different.
Different to gigging.
Yeah. So just bringing it back to the gigs that you organise on the parade, one of the things I've noticed, having been one of the bands that works for you occasionally as well, is it seems like a really nice balance between island-based musicians and the people that you bring across from the mainland. That's presumably a deliberate thing, right?
Yeah. The most important thing was, I can go in at wherever I do booking for bands, tributes, etc. It's not a case of, I'm going to just book all island bands. I'm going to bring all my friends from the cruise ships that I've known or contacts or things like that over and not use Isle of Wight acts. It's got to be a balance. The problem is I could fill it with Isle of Wight acts, and we've got the most amazing talent on the island. I mean, so I could fill it probably three times over at least with different bands. But you can see them at the pub through the winter and different things like that. I've got to think about that people will see them all the time. So you've got to think, right, okay, well, we'll put them on once and then give them a break the next year, then go the year after. And then I'll try and bring a few mainland bands down. But it's predominantly Isle of Wight acts, but I do try to throw a few in, and you've got to have something different. I try and go for ones. I might have brought them down before, but I try and go for ones that haven't been brought down before. Yeah. If I can. I mean, it doesn't always work out.
Yeah, no. I mean, there's,
we try.
I have to be a bit careful. So I don't want to put you on the spot now and have everyone accusing you of having favourites. But of the Isle of Wight talent that you get exposed to over the course of the year, is there a band in amongst that you think is maybe perhaps not quite getting the attention that they deserve, that perhaps you feel a little bit unsung?
It depends on what scale, because obviously there's two different types of musicians. So some of my friends went into recording and writing and went to get a record deal, and several of them have had record deals, and I faced a choice where I was going to be signed with two other people from the mainland. We were going to be signed as a band. But I had to work for next to nothing for years. I'd have been poor, really bad. Well, not rich, but I would have been really struggling. Like, seriously, like, you get paid £80 a week for like 2 or 3 years. Blah, blah. You're not, unless you're writing the songs, you're not making the money, things like that. Or carry on and earn an okay wage and do it. And I chose to go down this route. Yeah. So it depends. There's plenty that have written stuff on the island that have done it. I mean, the classic one of the names I say straight away was Dave Waite, who back in the 90s was signed. Most of the island guys at the time were touring around with Chesney Hawks, and they're called Manor. And I love that band. I've been listening to CD in my car recently, you know, and listening back and going, wow, they were so good, you know, and they should have made it massive, massive. They did really well and they toured all over. But, you know, so the island's got loads like that. If you go into little pubs and stuff and you hear voices, problem is in pubs and clubs, you're going to hear all the cover stuff, which is what people want to hear. Yeah. So at Cowsweet, I don't really book original bands. I book cover stuff because they want to get drunk and party. But there's so much talent. I couldn't pick one out in particular. It depends on what context. There's probably loads here that if they went into London now, they would storm it. Yeah. And it's getting up to London, and you've got the ferry fare, as you know, it comes at a cost into the gig. That's the problem, you know. It does affect us with gigging, you know, because if I go to do a gig in Southampton, I've got to allow 50 quid at least, let's say 100. So I always base it on 100 if it's a mainland gig, at least on top. So someone from the mainland has got to pay £100 more for me to come over. Yep. So why would they do that if they can get someone else? You know, that's the issue you have.
Yeah, that's the price we pay for living down here, isn't it? So you mentioned in passing then about kind of writing music. Is that something you've ever done? Do you write?
No, not really. I'll be honest with you, I've not sat down and gone into it. I would do it with someone else. I couldn't do it on my own. It's strange, but if you gave me lyrics, I could write music to it. Okay. But I would want someone to write to bounce off, and it's a weird thing. I've written jingles with Joey for a laugh. We've done funny things and some serious ones as well. But I'm not really a singer songwriter. I don't suddenly go, oh, that's come into my head, this melody or these were. I'm not like that. I'm more of the performance side of it, to be honest with you, and then the organising side. So I wish I was, but I'm not a recording artist as such.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And we've talked a lot, you know, about how busy you are and all that kind of stuff. I mean, is there anything that you do, you know, to kind of chill out and relax?
I used to play golf quite a bit. I was never very good, but I used to play quite a lot. Fortunately, just over a year ago, I started getting really tired, and I was struggling, and people noticed it, and I was struggling to get out of bed even some days. And I was having tests, and they said lack of vitamin D. And eventually it was glandular fever. So I've had glandular fever for over a year now. And it's hard for people to understand, because they'll see me up on stage doing a gig, you know, and I might be pumping out Bruno Mars and everyone's dancing and I'm like that. But the next day I can't speak to anyone and I'm in bed and I'm shattered and I feel... And you have good days and bad days. And I've really noticed that. And it is unlike me. Like you said, I'm a hyperactive person. And for me to be tired all the time is, well, not all the time, but on certain days is like really hard. I hate it, and it's not me. And you try and get up, and you try just to get up and get a shower and get changed, you feel like you've run a marathon. And people that haven't had it don't understand, really, because just think, oh, you're being lazy or something. And I had to cancel a lot of gigs for the first time ever last year, and that was very unlike me. I don't normally do it. I'll battle through it.
That's part of the deal, isn't it? I mean, I think with the being self-employed and stuff as well.
Yeah, you know, don't get paid. Yeah. No sick pay for us, is there?
That's how it goes. So just looking forwards now. So you've got, you know, you're still gigging. You've got what you do with Cowsweet. You've got what you do at the Con Club in Shanklin. Is there anything else that you've got your eye on that you think maybe somewhere down the line you might like to turn your hand to?
Yeah, there's a the thing is now I'm doing so much booking now for holiday parks and things like that, and I think that I need to go in. I need to set up. There are a couple of smaller agencies on the island, but I need to set up a corporate agency, I think, in the future. That's what I'm going to be doing, I think, because I will gig less. I'm not one of these where I'll take a venue on and then I'll put myself in the venue or constantly. I'm not like that at all. I want to see everyone working. I want to see everyone paid. I want to see my clients can afford to do it and give them the best acts we can with the budget we have. And I think that's one way I would go. I've wanted to do a festival, one in particular, which is in 2015, I was driving along in my car back from a gig and Radio 1 was on. And I kept seeing at the gig, everyone putting on Facebook, Radio 1, this is amazing. Radio 1, what is it? What is this? This is amazing. This is amazing. And it was the Proms. And I got home and I went on to iPlayer. And what had happened was they'd brought Pete Tong in and they wanted to celebrate 20 years of Radio 1 in Ibiza. And they got this orchestra with a guy called Jules Buckley, who's like a genius. And this orchestra played all, not dance, rave. There were some ravey ones on there, but there's some classical bits. There's some great 90s stuff with disco feel as well. And they did all these tracks from Ibiza, but with a full live orchestra. And I was just blown away. And any, you ask any of my friends, they're sick of me going on about it. I play it to everyone. But it was Pete Tong with a live orchestra. It was amazing. And the first thing, I went to see it at the O2, and I've seen concerts, I've seen my heroes, I've seen Stevie Wonder, I've seen football, I've seen rugby. This was by far the best thing I've ever seen. The atmosphere, I've never experienced anything like it. Within 10 seconds, the whole of the stadium was up, dancing. And it was bizarre, and it was Alison Limerick, Where Love Lives, and then you'd go to a bit slightly bit newer stuff. And I thought, I really want to bring that and put that at Osborne House. Okay. And yes, they're doing it commercially slightly at the moment with the O2s and that, but I think they would go for something like that. If we said that if we could get it at Osborne House as the sunset goes down, and it's not a rave, but we're with a live orchestra playing those hits like that, that's my goal. And I've wanted to do it for a couple of years, but it's a lot of work, yeah. And financially, I mean, to underwrite something like that, you'd be talking tens, if not hundreds of thousands. So you've got to sell it out. But that's my goal at the minute. That one, that project. That's what I want to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a pretty big one. It sounds pretty cool as well. I like the sound of that. So before we sort of start wrapping things up, you've been a musician since you were 12 years old. Still doing it now. Seen a lot of things come and a lot of things go. What would you say is what's a bad piece of advice that you hear given to musicians, aspiring musicians, a lot?
Well, I don't know if this sort of comes into the question. The problem is if I had children now, if I do have children, I probably wouldn't want them to go into this business now, because there are a lot of cutthroat people out there. There always have been. That people have gone about years, stories, managers, with famous bands in the past. But I think for me, it's a slightly different subject, but programmes like X Factor and like those, Pop Idols, I don't agree with them now. I've seen a different side of it. I admire Simon Cowell for what he's done as a businessman. He's a genius. But it's completely ruined our business. And the thing we have is that when we turn up, somebody can sing five songs on a karaoke, suddenly thinks they can do a gig. But what they don't realise is the hours and hours and thousands of pounds of equipment and stuff and rehearsal and everything. They don't see that side of it. So all they do is see you singing for 2 hours, a pub, and think you've got the easiest job in the world and that they can do it. And as much as I love iPads and iPods and they're brilliant, they've also caused a lot of problems now. We see at weddings and stuff now, everyone's an expert DJ, they want to put their music on, and it's changed the way things have gone. And people say, oh, DJ's got it easy. But I've seen DJs, weddings in particular, are really hard. One of the hardest gigs ever to do, because you've got so many different generations, age gap there, that, you know, granddad doesn't want to listen to Tiny Temper, and the kids don't want to listen to the Eagles, you know, but they expect you to play that, and you got to do it all. And it's reading the audience, building it up to the end of the night, and you get that a lot. And another thing you get is people that will come up and tell you they're a professional, will come up and say, oh, I'm a professional, can I get up and sing with you, or like that. Whereas I'm one of these, if I've got a night off, I want a night off. If I'm not bothered about it. If it was Earth, Wind and Fire and they asked me to get up and sing, then that'd be a different ball game. I would ask. But no, it's changed the whole business. And I'm not bitter, because I didn't have a record deal and I lost it, and I didn't have millions and lost it. It's not about that. I'm not a bitter person. I'm just scared at the way it's gone. And it's changed. But on the other hand, I remember going when I was at a private school, and you didn't have things like Glee and programs like that. And programs like that now have brought in acting, musicals, singing, instruments, everything, made it much more accessible at schools now. At my school, we had a little recording studio, but most of my friends were training to be doctors, lawyers, solicitors there, and I wanted to be a pop star. And it wasn't frowned upon, but they didn't take me seriously, you know. They didn't want to. And that's the difference now. So for the kids, it's much easier for them to get into it, but it can be a really nasty business, and you got to be able to be prepared to take the knockbacks, because, you know, sometimes it isn't personal. You know, I get some amazing bands send me stuff through, but I know it won't work at the venue, and I think it's unfair that I would put them and throw them under a bus, you know, or throw my client under the bus if it's too loud or whatever. Some things work, you know. Some people will like me and some people won't like me, and I'm fine with that. You know, I have no issue with it, because people have got different tastes in music, and that's the way it is. So it's a tricky business. There are some good things, but you have to be really careful now. Agents, managers, you know, there's some really nice ones out there, but there's some really dodgy ones as well.
Do you see a light at the end of that tunnel? Is there anything that gives you a sense that, you know, because most things in life kind of go in cycles, right?
Yeah.
You know, it goes up and it goes down. And I agree with you that the impact that those sort of TV shows have had on the music industry is pretty huge, and, you know, covers a lot of ground. Is there anything that makes you think we might be coming back out the other side of it?
At the moment, no. I've been honest, no. The thing is that, as you will know, and a lot of us will, is that we see the other side of it. I know a lot of the people that have been on there. I know how it's staged, and it makes good TV. My own mum, I never forget, saying to me, "Did you see those two lads? They work in their parents' bakery. They bake buns. They've never had a singing lesson in their life, and suddenly they both sung opera." And I said, "Mum, I've worked with them on the cruise ship about 2 years ago." She said, no, you haven't. And I pulled up the YouTube video, and I said, "They've made it look good TV." And I get that. All right, it's clever and all that, but unfortunately, it's people get sucked into it, and they don't see the other side. Some people have done really well out of it, you know, but I've seen some that have had careers ruined with it. Because what you've got to remember is that if I was on there and I was £200 a night at a local club, and then I went on there and I came in the top 10, and then suddenly Simon Cowell's company are charging £2,000 a night, then my local venues are going to be upset, because they won't want to be able to, one, they won't want to, two, they won't be able to afford that. And suddenly you just drop them and you're going off and you're doing, and it's not like that. I don't believe in it. And also I think it's false hope a lot of the time, you know, and I hate particularly the use of when they say about some of the singers and call them cruise ship singers, because I've worked with some singers who on cruises that are the most amazing singers in the world, you know, and I don't like that. And it's the same with holiday camps, and that you see it all different. When you were a red coat, Butlins, it was an honour and a privilege to be a red coat, and they weren't paid great money and they worked really long hours, but it was a privilege, and it was like you had to be really good to get that. And now they struggle to get, like, especially male singers, they really struggle to get male singers at the holiday parks. Because people want to go out and they think they can do it straight away around the pubs and hotels, you know, and don't need to go through that. They need the training of the camps and all the bad bits, yeah, which we've all done.
Yeah. It's almost like, you know, sort of college, university for entertainers, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's sort of rite of passage, do a couple of years there and, you know, really get to actually learn your skill, learn the trade.
It's all about the experience. For me, it is about the experience, because you will see a great singer, but if they can only sing five songs, that's no good. You've got to be able to do 40 straight away, you know, because you just don't know when. And you've got to be able to maintain it 6 nights a week, 7 nights a week, things like that. You know, that's the thing, and the experience. And you're going to have some really bad ones. I've had some terrible ones, you know, we all have. I've walked in and played to two people before, you know, and it's the thing. Or you can walk into a venue and there might be no one there. So you go, right, what do? You play? Well, if you play and all the windows and doors are open, people hear it, so they're going to come in. So it's one of those things. You just got to get on with it. But everyone is an expert and has an opinion on it. And whatever you say or do is not right.
Yeah, that's very true, very true. Simon, I really, really appreciate your time today. And just before we wrap things up, it's just a question that I'm kind of putting to most of the people I'm chatting to. Is there something on the island that you feel not enough people take advantage of, whether that's a venue or one of the attractions on the island or something else about the islands? Is there something that you think, wow, why don't more people know about this? Why don't more people do this?
Yeah, it's all right. So it was a weird thing. I love the island, even though I've never moved away as such. I've worked away and stuff, but I love the island. I will promote it. So anything I've ever been on, so if I've been on a cruise ship, I always get them to say, ladies and gentlemen, Simon from the Isle of Wight, Simon Ledger. I always make a point of saying from the Isle of Wight because I love promoting it. And the amount of people that you come up and go, you're from the island, I live on the island, blah, blah, you don't know. But it promotes it and people ask. And of course you get asked the question, do you need a passport, whatever, you know, all that. But I will always promote, I love it here. I won't go into it because it'd be too long. It's a completely different story. I'm pro-link with it. And I think the island has to have it now for our tourism side, especially for the musician side. I'm seeing pubs and clubs shutting down, struggling. It's getting shorter and shorter the season. From a musician entertainer side, we really need it, and I know other businesses do. But then you've got the other side of it, when you see events and you put things on, and people, you see a lot of people moaning saying there's nothing to do on the island, there's nothing to do. Somebody will put something on and then it won't be supported, and they just don't understand the background to it. So, for instance, John Giddings, I think, was genius. And if people are going on there, say he's earning millions out of it, he deserves every single penny he makes out of it, in my opinion, because he took the gamble, he funded it, he put the money up there, he did it. If he made 50 million a year, which I doubt he does, but if he did, it's good on him for doing it. And it annoys me that he's put things on. Now, I, this year, won't be going to the festival because I'm busy working. But for me, it wasn't like, oh, I want to go and see that act, something like that. But I would never knock it. I will promote that Isle of Wight Festival and say to everyone, you should go. It's got a great lineup, blah, blah, blah. Same as I will with any other event. It's people have got to support it. But then you've got to think of the cost, because the island doesn't have the money that some of the mainland does. You know, it isn't as much money around. But people have to appreciate how much these things cost and how much they cost to put on, the back behind the scenes things with it, you know, and how much celebrities cost, you know. It's nuts. It's gone through the roof. If you want an 80s band now, the figures are unbelievable, and it's a big, big gamble. And so I would say you've got to get out there. It might not be your taste. Like, you know, I understand if I put on a Michael Jackson tribute, you know, some people won't like Michael Jackson. I get that. But if we're putting on a variety of stuff, which there is so much stuff on there, maybe too many festivals now, there are so many festivals, you've got such a choice, you've got to go and support it, is what I say, because otherwise you'll start losing them and we won't have as much.
Yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree with that. As I say, Simon, really, really appreciate your time today. And just before we wrap things up, have you got anything that, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you or follow you or find out what you're up to?
it's, if you go on Facebook, I've got my Simon Ledger Music Facebook page. You can follow me on there. Put a lot up about gigs and stuff on there. SimonLedger.com as well. So you can follow me on there. Thanks for having me, Joe. Anyway, been really good chatting with you.
No, it's been a pleasure having you on, mate. Appreciate that. And I'll put all those links in the show notes, ladies and gents. So, Simon Ledger, thank you once again.
Thank you.
That was Simon Ledger. Thank you very much for listening. Really hope you enjoyed it. As always, details of all the things that Simon and I talked about can be found at my website, which is joeredston.com. That's joeredston.com. There you'll also find my blog and information about the book that I recently published, as well as all the other episodes of the podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, we really appreciate it if you can find time to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from, or just, you know, tell a couple of friends about what it is that we're doing here. Thank you very much for listening. We really appreciate it, and we'll catch up with you next time. Hey everybody, I'm working on a new podcast project at the moment. This one is about people who have faced and overcome problems. If you know someone, maybe they have recovered from a serious accident or illness, perhaps they beat an addiction of some description, or maybe their life just hit a bit of a rough patch and they found a way to get through it. Whatever it might be, if you or someone you know would be happy to share the story with me, then I'd really love to hear from you. You can get in touch with me via my website, which is joeredston.com. That's joeredston.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks very much.